This episode of Creative Control Daily is sponsored by Blue Chew. Guys, remember the days when you were always ready to go? Well, now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed. Listen up. BlueChew.com. That's blue like the color blue. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. If you could benefit from more confidence where it counts, Blue Chew is the fast and easy way to enhance your performance. Blue Chew is prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor's office or wait in line at the pharmacy. It ships right to your door in a discreet packet. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. And best of all, there's no more awkwardness. And right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code CREATIVE. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code CREATIVE, to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring Creative Control Daily. Creative Control with Joe Fiend. This is episode 77, and my guest tonight is a former WWE Hardcore and European champion, as well as a former World Tag Team champion and current TNA producer, and that is Mr. Al Snow. Al, how are you doing tonight?
Doing very well, and thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming on, and I guess, you know, usually we don't go too linear with the questions here, just kind of, you know, kind of free-flowing, but, you know, there's really only one way to start, and that is to ask you, what drew you to pro wrestling initially, and how did you decide that that was what you wanted to pursue as your career?
You know, I think that I've tried to figure this question out for a long time.
Yeah.
And I've never really come up with an adequate answer. Other than the fact that, you know, I believe that I've been, basically mad all my life, not mad like angry, but mad. So, you know, and not insane, because insane means that you view reality, from a completely different standpoint. Just madness is you know, something unique and different, and you know, professional wrestling was basically the rabbit hole that I went down, and I've been so grateful that I've gotten to be a part of it for as long as I've gotten to be a part of it. You know, it's whenever it comes to an end, I'll have to find something to satiate the madness again and going down another rabbit hole. So
I think
it's going to be hard to find another rabbit hole that's been quite as unique and fun as this one.
Right, and I know that you've done some acting, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And you've also been a wrestling trainer. You know, back in the day, you trained guys like Dan Severn and Blue Meanie, and been a trainer at OVW. And, of course, you have the Al Snow Wrestling Academy open in the UK. But back when you wanted to make your entrance into wrestling, it obviously wasn't quite as easy as it is today. And I know you've told the story before, so if you want to know. If you don't want to go into the whole thing, that's fine. But you did attempt initially to get into pro wrestling via the Andersons, Gene and Ole Anderson. And I, you know, if the fans haven't heard it, you have a pretty interesting and, you know, interesting for the listener, but painful for you story about that experience, if you wouldn't mind telling it.
Well, it's not painful at all. I mean, it was just. It was,
well, I mean, not the memory, but physically.
Physically? It was brutal. At the time that I tried to get into professional wrestling, it was a very closed, very secular business, and the reason was because the people that were in it, that was all they did for a living. And it only takes one person to ruin the illusion. And I'll diverge for a second.
Sure.
The belief that, you know, just because you know that wrestling's fake, or, you know, that you're smart for the wrestling business is absurd. Everybody, and I do mean everyone, has known that professional wrestling is fake, i.e., that the outcome is predetermined for decades. They've known since the 30s. And, you know, people have continued to pay money to watch professional wrestling over these decades for one reason, and that is because the talent within the wrestling business adhered to kayfabe, and kayfabe was nothing more than a respect for the audience. You know, the same, it's no different than what movie producers do, where they spend millions of dollars, you know, in trying to keep a continuity, doing everything they can. If it's a period piece, to make sure that, you know, the fabric that's used is exactly what was used at that time frame, the wallpaper, et cetera, so that you're immersed into that world and can enjoy the story that's being told during the time that you're there. At no point in time do they want you to ever be taken out of it. And I'm sure you've probably went to some movies where, you know, a silly thing like, you know, there's a car chase and 1 minute car rounds the corner and it's got a big dent in the door, and then it rounds another corner and it doesn't have a dent.
Right, of course.
And that one little thing completely takes you out. And the whole point in this thing is that back in the day, it only took that one person on a wrestling show to destroy that illusion or break that facade and then take the audience out to where they would no longer want to pay. So it was a very, very closed business, very protected and very difficult to get in. You know, at the time I would call around all the different promotional offices that happened to find wrestlers' phone numbers. I'd call them and I'd just constantly be getting turned down. And it just so happened that I had gotten a hold of Gene Anderson, who was in the office, the Crockett's office, one day, and he informed me they were having a tryout in October of that year, which was the year that I graduated from high school. And I'm like, this is it. This is my chance. Now, I had met ultimately the guy that did train me by the name of Jim Lancaster. I'd met him right before that. And he did everything he could to dissuade me from doing it, you know, and even recommended that I go to Al Costello in Detroit. He had no interest in training me at the time. I was like, I'm going, you know, to Charlotte, North Carolina. So I made up my mind and, you know, sold my car and, you know, got a bus ticket. And now that I think about it, I'm like, why didn't I sell my car? Because I just drove the car down. But, and it would have been a much more enjoyable ride than riding on a Greyhound bus.
Yeah.
Those things are a cruel and unusual punishment. Got there, took a 5-mile walk from the bus station out to the Charlotte Coliseum and found a hotel and, you know, stayed the night. And, got up the next day and on a Sunday and went in and Gene Anderson was there, and there was probably 30 or 35 other guys that came to try out. And we all signed a release, and, you know, it's the first time I'd ever signed a release, so Gene was the only guy there, so I put Gene's name in there. And Ole showed up with about 6 guys that they had been working with. Now, the smallest guy was like my size now, and the rest of them just kept getting bigger. Mm. And we all, Ole, you know, barked commands at us. We all went out the back parking lot of the Charlotte Coliseum and ran 5 miles. We came in, we did 500 free squats, and then we went and we ran the steps of the Coliseum up, back down, over, up, back down, over, up, back down, over, up. Once we were done with that, we came down on the Coliseum floor. We did 400 push-ups, and then we, and it didn't matter how long it took. And then we did jumping jacks when it still wasn't our turn to go in the ring, we would put a person on their back, run the length of the Coliseum back and forth.
Wow.
So they basically did whatever they could to physically wear you out and try to break you just by having, you know, working you like that. And a lot of guys did quit while we were doing that. And then if you made it through all of that, you got in the ring. At the time, Ole was teaching these guys how to pancake a guy out, belly him out. You know, you'd get on all fours, your body's shaking from exhaustion, and, you know, and then you literally had to start in the amateur position on all fours.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy would have the advantage, and you had to get out and away from him. You had to out-wrestle him. And, somehow I made it through 4 of the 5 guys, got to the 5th guy, who got me on my stomach, rear chin locked me, grapevined my leg, and, you know, always in my face screaming to give up. And, you know, I somehow got back to all fours. So, you know, Ole said, do it again. And he got me again. And Ole was screaming in my face again, do you give up? And I probably would have, but, you know, he had my jaw clamped shut, so I couldn't really say anything. Mm. So, Ole, you know, yelled at the guy. He got off of me. And then Gene slid in the ring. And, again, I had to get back down on all fours. And at this point, I'm completely just, you know, quivering. My muscles are just wanting to give out.
Of course.
And Gene began to, you know, wrestle me. But then he just started for legitimately fish hooking my mouth, pulling my hair, you know, ran my face into the bottom rope, which was basically steel cable, and broke my nose. Was basically beating me up. So I'm still struggling, and I'm almost out from underneath him. And he goes to try to grab my testicles, and I grab his, and we're rolling around on that. I've got a hold of his, and he's now rolled over on top of him. He's got his thumb in my eye, and is screaming, do you want to lose your eye? Do you want to lose your eye? Mm. And Ole now is the voice of reason, pulls Gene off, and Gene kicks me out of the ring. I go to the back, clean up. The blood off my face, and come back out, shake their hands, because I wasn't going to let them get over on me. That's what time the show was that night. Went back to the hotel. Once I was back at the hotel, found the mirror where I had bite marks all over my back where he had bitten me. Oh, and so, you know, out of all of those people that tried out, one guy had been pulled aside. And it was funny because years later, I had was riding in Smoky Mountain with Sandy Scott, who had been in, you know, the Crockett office as well.
Right.
And he mentioned, because back then they didn't have wrestling schools and all that. They would take a guy that they wanted to break into the business, and they would take him to like a YMCA or something and start teaching him the basics. And he said he thought he had seen a guy that the way I had described him, like for 1 or 2 days. And then by that point, Ole had just, you know, wore the guy out to the point to where the guy just quit and never showed back up. So,
how does that having that experience influence the way that you train guys?
Well, I train people the way that I was trained, but I understand why, you know, they did what they did back then. I do, and I don't condone it, but I do understand because, for one, you want to make sure that somebody really wants to do this.
Yeah,
you know, but because the number one thing that to be anything in professional wrestling, you have to have passion. To really any entertainment venue, you've got to have the passion to do it. You can't just want to do it and think, ooh, wow, I'm going to go be a wrestler. You have to really want. I mean, think about this. In this, you really want to succeed. Because you're guaranteed, if you base your success on the fact that you're going to be in WWE, which is the ultimate, then you're about 99.9% guaranteed you're going to fail.
Right.
Because there are so few guys that get to that level, on any level up there. And, you know, every one of those people that are involved in WWE are, you know, steps above anyone else. Because, they, you know, whether they're at the bottom of the card or the middle of the card, they are in WWE. And there are literally thousands upon thousands of people all around this entire planet that want to be where they're at and will never even get an opportunity. And those guys at least are there or have been there in some capacity. So, but to get to that and to truly succeed, you gotta imagine if we go someplace, go out in the water, in the lake, I grab you by the back of the head and I stick your head under that water and I hold you there and I don't let you come up. Your only thought's going to be that you want air. The longer I hold you there, the more desperate you're going to be to want to breathe. That's how bad you want. You have to want to be a professional wrestler if you have any chance, any hope of success. And that's the truth. That's not an exaggeration. That's not me, you know, putting it over because I was a professional wrestler. It's a life. It's probably one of the hardest, most challenging physically and emotionally and mentally lifestyles you could take on. That's the truth because it never stops. It never ends. You're only as good as the last time you performed. And you can perform 200, 250 days a year. And all it takes is for you to make one mistake and all the years, effort, sacrifice, it all go away. The never-ending game of chess and poker.
It's that time of year when divisions are decided, champions are crowned, and legends are born. It's time for the NFL playoffs. You've waited and watched all year as your team rose to the top or fell to the bottom, but now it's your turn to win big. You've heard the name just about everywhere, MyBookie. They're the industry's leading online sportsbook and casino, and it's not hard to understand why, with thousands of lines to bet on all your favorite sports. NFL, NBA, and college ball, check, check, and check. MMA and soccer, they've got all the latest odds, period. Take advantage of MyBookie's prop builder and live in-game betting where every single run, throw, and touchdown is another chance for you to put cash in your pocket. Visit their mobile-friendly website today and get your deposit matched halfway up to $1,000 by using the promo code CREATIVE when you make your first deposit. The best part is they make it simple with a variety of ways to deposit instantly, including credit card, bank transfer, Bitcoin, and more. Whether you're at home or on the go, on your laptop or your phone, it's not too late to make your New Year's resolution a resolution to get paid. Bet, win, and get paid at MyBookie. And don't forget, use the promo code CREATIVE to get matched halfway up to $1,000 on your first deposit. Now, you know, after you were trained and worked, you know, some indies and promoted some shows and things like that, worked for some NWA affiliates, I was wondering, I don't think you've ever covered this, because you had a relationship with ECW as well. When they did the NWA tournament in ECW, and, you know, the famous scene where Shane threw the belt down and supposedly double-crossed the NWA promoters, what was your take on that as a pro wrestler and as someone that had, you know, worked with NWA affiliates?
You know, there was a code of honor, and it did upset me, you know, because it was a line that was crossed. You know, I understand, you know, why Paul and Shane did it. You know, and it worked because it got them noticed and it catapulted them into another, you know, another step up. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to do those kind of things, you know. And there have been things like that that have been done throughout the history of, you know, wrestling on different levels. And, you know, but it, you know, much like with Vince and Bret Hart, you know, it upset me that back then too, you know. And, because there was always this code of conduct that, you know, between the promoter and the wrestler, between, you know, promoters and their territories, et cetera. And, you know, those lines were, you know, with those types of actions, those lines were being blatantly erased, you know, that there would be no more respect for the etiquette that once was. But again, I'm not knocking it, because in each instance, it, you know, it served a purpose and it worked. Yep. For the betterment of the, you know, professional wrestling as a whole.
How did you feel about ECW when you wound up there the following year? You had some, you know, a match with Taz, a match with Chris Benoit during your time there. Do you know what the plans were for you and ECW at that time, or was it more like a, you know, a few match tryout, or were you supposed to be there for the long term?
As far as I knew, I was supposed to be there for the long term, but you know, I don't know if Paul, you know, Paul, I don't think he's ever really had any real plans for me in any way. You know, both times that I was there. You know, I think Sabu probably, you know, and maybe Taz, maybe Tommy Dreamer went, you know, on my behalf, and, you know, politics, and, you know, Paul kind of placated them and brought me in, you know, but I don't think he ever had any real plans. And, you know, then I was offered an opportunity by Cornette, to come to Smoky Mountain, which I had known Cornette for, you know, years prior, And he never had any interest because I never had a character. You know, I was just known as the best kept secret in wrestling, which was terrific. You know, I'd worked on, you know, lots of territories and, you know, the several territories in the beginning when I first started out. And then when those died out, you know, I just kept working and nobody really heard of me. And, you know, Cornette knew of me because when, you know, Crockett's tried to come up and run the Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, West Virginia territories, all the old Sheik's territories.
Right.
You know, they would, you know, Marnix would come up to, you know, road agent, and they would use, you know, several local guys on the shows, and I was one of those. And, you know, I knew Cornette, but he didn't see anything in me until, you know, he saw me do a, you know, Dan Severn and I were at the UFC 4, I think it was. Or,
yeah.
Yeah. In Tulsa, and, you know, I made a smart-ass comment, and, you know, Cornette was watching it at the time, and then that was it. That was what got me the opportunity with Cornette. And, you know, I had spoken to Paul, and, you know, Paul, you know, I told Cornette I was working for Paul, and Cornette was fine with me working for both places. And Paul was like, yeah, sure. And then he just never booked me again. So, I was, only with Cornette, which was, it worked out. It all fell into place because, that gave me the opportunity to be seen by Jim Ross and, people with WCW, Eric Bischoff had grown interested. And, it was a good time.
You always hear, I've had a lot of guests on the show. You always hear about how guys have to make the most of their opportunities, make the most of their TV time. And one thing that I specifically remember is your Smoky Mountain days and the promos that you did when you were teamed up with Glenn Jacobs, Kane. And, just some of the silly promos that you did, mocking the Rock and Roll Express and things like that. And they were just always favorites of mine back then. But what was your, what are your memories of teaming with Glenn back then and, of Smoky Mountain in general?
Being in Smoky Mountain at that time was just fantastic. I mean, both mentally and physically and creatively, I was just clicking on all cylinders. The only regret that I have was that I was supposed, and I didn't understand, and I was doing the wrong business. I was getting myself over and not being the heel that truly Cornette wanted me to be when he first brought me in, which was the mouth that would pick the fight, and then Glenn would be the guy that actually was the muscle that would stop it, that would do the fighting. And I did a lot of it myself, and that was just, I should have, now when I look back, if I were watching my old self, I'd be admonishing me and telling me to not do things in matches and, put Glenn in there at different times. And that was a mistake of mine. Mm. And, not fully realizing and understanding how to do proper business and the role that I should have played in that.
You used the Shinobi gimmick on the Indies. I'm sorry. I was going to say, you used the Shinobi gimmick on the Indies a little bit before it wound up debuting on WWE TV, and you also used Avatar when you finally went up in WWE, WWF. Shinobi and Avatar, were they characters of your own creation?
Yeah. Avatar was not. Avatar was Vince's, and Vince and I spoke directly about that. But a lot of things, it was going to be a difficult thing transition because here I'd been a smart-ass chicken shit heel the entire time I was in Smoky Mountain, mm-hmm. and now I'm being brought up to be this, mysterious babyface. And, who's supposed to be reminiscent of Mortal Kombat and Power Rangers and all that. And that was what, Vince was trying to capitalize on at the time. And I had just the one match on TV and a handful of matches at the house shows. And then that was it. I was still on the shelf because it just, it was never communicated to me or, explained to me or anything. So, it didn't work. The Shinobi gimmick, I had literally started, because I put on an outfit and developed a way to move physically and wrestle completely different, so that I could wrestle my students on their shows. It's like we ran a show in their hometown or near their hometown. They were going to have their family and friends. It was a way that I could guarantee them that they were going to have a really good match and look really good in front of their hometown crowd. And nobody would know it was me. And it started because it was a character. It started getting so over that I started getting booked more with that than I did as myself, which was hilarious.
Yeah.
And, so then, it was kind of just tossed out there that I, wrestled Tajiri that one night on Raw. Mm. And, the writers wanted me to take, have him take the mask off. And I'm like, no, you shouldn't take it off. And then don't the next day, Vince is like, oh, that was the greatest match you've ever had. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, well, you should do that more often. And why haven't you done it before? I go, well, I did against Shawn Michaels. And like, he didn't know. And he goes, why'd you take the mask off? I go, because I was told, the writers told me to take the mask off. He goes, you shouldn't have taken that mask off. And I said, I know, I told them, So, I learned a lot of lessons with that and realized that when I get in the ring, it was my responsibility. And even if the writers tell you to do something, sometimes you just you just can't. You got to go with your gut and not do it.
From there, they, of course, you know, they went with the Leaf Cassidy gimmick, and you teamed with Marty Jannetty's The New Rockers. But towards the end there, there was a couple of instances on television where, you know, Leaf Cassidy would lose a match and then kind of, you know, have a you know, nervous breakdown type thing or a tantrum. He, you know, you went after Jim Ross and things like that. Was that something that was in their plans, or was that something that you were doing to lead to your entrance in the ECW? Or reemergence in ECW.
Well, it was me just doing it in general. And, you know, I just felt that I wanted to, and nobody called me down and nobody told me to stop doing it, you know. So I just kept doing it. You know, I just would lose and I'd flip out. And, you know, I figured that if anybody, you know, if I was that happy-go-lucky kind of guy that much, that I'd have to have a screw loose and then I'd start snapping a little bit. And they, you know, they won't stop you. They'll let you do stuff, you know, and see where it goes. And I was on my way to doing that, and I had already begun talks with Candido, Chris Candido. God, mm-hmm. I love him. And he was Paulie's right hand man, and he facilitated Paulie going to Vince and basically, or Bruce Pritchard and Vince, and asking, you know, basically saying, hey, let me, you know, bring him over here. You know, since Paul was actually kind of secretly being used as like a developmental
right.
program. And then once I got there, I just continued. I would lose and I would snap and go crazy and just figured, you know, anybody had been doing what I've been doing as long as I've been doing it at that time, which was 16 years, that, you know, and that frustration was in me that, you know, eventually I'd have a nervous breakdown and tried to manifest that in my physical actions in the ring as much as I could until, you know, I was reading a book on abnormal psychology and about a woman who had, you know, schizophrenia with transference disorders and then found the styrofoam head, and that was it. And that was the thing, you know.
Prior to the...
I found my voice.
Prior to the head gimmick, when you came in and you had one of your first big matches was with Rob Van Dam on pay-per-view, I believe it was Hardcore Heaven 97. And, you know, when you read interviews or talk to guys or even hear from Van Damme himself, it seems like some guys really like to work with Rob and some guys don't. And so I want to ask, how was your experience wrestling with RVD? Did you enjoy wrestling Rob, or were you kind of on the other side of the fence?
Yeah.
You did, yeah?
No, I was fine with him. You know, Rob sometimes can be a little reckless, and, you know, that's why guys didn't like to work with him. But the one thing about Rob is that, you know, he never... If you gave it back to him, he never complained.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he never whined and moaned or, you know, got mad because you did something back to him. He just took it and understood and went on about it. And you know, when you work with guys like that, then that's it. That's fine.
When you had the whole, you know, the head gimmick going on in the beginning there, it was like one of the big events in the ECW arena, you know, along the lines of the Sandman coming out to his music and drinking the beer. And it was the same thing with Al Snow in the head coming out to Prodigy. What were some of your favorite moments? And was your favorite venue the ECW arena? Or did you have some other favorite venues in ECW?
Well, the arena was always my favorite. And then in Queens at the Elks Lodge was, but every place was amazing. I mean, every place was awesome. And, you know, my favorite moment was when we went to, you know, in New Jersey to, gosh, bless it,
Asbury
for the pay-per-view.
Was it Asbury Park?
Asbury Park.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's 5,000 or 6,000 heads out there. And, you know, they hit the strobe lights and it looked like a, literally, you know, no pun intended, it looked like a snowstorm.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was amazing. It was an amazing, you know, experience. And, you know, I can't thank Paul enough for just giving me the freedom and the opportunity to do it.
To jump a little bit ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Paul's brilliance is in his, you know, allowing, you know, the talent to be the talent. And then he, you know, worked. He was a producer. He would produce me when I was doing Sunday Night Heat, doing commentary on Sunday Night Heat when we were live at the restaurant a couple of times. And I got to tell you, he is a genius when it comes to that stuff. He was brilliant. I mean, he would give you just the right things at just the right time. And it was, God, it was awesome. And then, you know, never got to have that again. And that was, it was such a shame.
Just to jump a little ahead, and then if we have, you know, obviously if you still have time, we can go back to some of that, that time period when you were in ECW leaving. But the question is, you know, there's been several ECW revivals, and you've been there for, you know, the one night stand pay-per-views and the TNA, Hardcore Justice, and even up to the Extreme Reunion in Philadelphia. What have your thoughts been on the ECW reunion events and pay-per-views, and even on the WWE ECW reboot in 2006 when they tried to make it a separate brand?
Well, that's a lot.
Yeah, sorry.
You know, for me personally, I enjoyed, you know, the reunions and the revivals, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
Business-wise, were they the right thing? I mean, you know, it was a particular moment with a particular set of talent at a particular time. You know, everything worked. Everything has a life. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and everything dies. And, you know, I think, you know, ECW, as much as everybody would like to recreate it, you're never going to recreate what was. Now, you can, you know, like Tommy Dreamer is doing a great job of, you know, taking something and making something new.
Yeah.
You know, with the heart of ECW, but still making it something new and unique under its own with the House of Hardcore. And I think that was, you know, the thing that a lot of people miss is that they tried to recreate the original ECW, and that was, it's not the right time anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it lived and died, and now you've got to use what was and create something new out of it. For the national ECW, when WWE bought it and, you know, tried to make a separate brand, what a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, doing professional wrestling is a lot like making a comic book movie. You know, you want to produce a comic book movie that the fans that read the comic books and that know the characters and know the stories and know the motivations will enjoy. But you have to do it in such a way that the largest portion of the audience, which are those that don't read comic books, that don't know the characters, don't know the stories, don't know the motivations, are drawn into and want to pay to see the movie.
Yeah.
ECW was fantastic, but it had a very small secular audience. And now it's on a national stage, so there, you know, it's got to be done in a different way to try to appeal to a broader mass audience. So it's not going to be exactly the same, you know. And you know, unfortunately, it didn't stay true enough to what brought it to the dance to where that core group of those secular fans now turned against it, which would be the same as if Ben Affleck had really sucked as Batman in the latest Batman versus Superman movie, because it would have turned all of the comic book fans that love Batman totally against the movie and totally against anything going forward that would have Ben Affleck in it as far as, you know, a Batman role.
Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Well, you can get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream and you could save thousands in interest. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with autopay and excellent credit. And the rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, there are absolutely no fees. The application is quick and easy and is 100% online. You can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. I remember before Lightstream ever worked with Creative Control Daily, I actually heard about their services on another podcast. And it couldn't have come at a better time. It was after Christmas, and I racked up some bills I probably shouldn't have. So after I heard the ad, I checked out the website, and everything that was said sounded too good to be true. But ultimately, it was true. It was so easy, quick, and convenient. I wish I would have found out about Lightstream sooner, actually. And I 1,000% recommend it to everyone. And if you want to take care of your debts and fix up your credit like I did, check out Lightstream and apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. And the only way to get this discount is go to lightstream.com/creative. LIGHTSTREAM.com/creative. CREATIVE. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.50% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/creative for more information. At the initial ECW One Night Stand, you were in the ring when the Blue Meanie, who was your student, and JBL had, you know, what turned into a real fight in the midst of all the brawling going on around it. What was your feelings being, you know, that close to that situation, and how did you feel about, you know, what happened with JBL after, which really wasn't that much? They didn't really seem to punish him that much anyway.
I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, to be quite honest, I'm still not 100% sure because I wasn't privy to anything or whatever. So anything I would say would just be pure speculation.
Right.
You know, I know that he, you know, Meanie and JBL are the best friends now.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a dead issue. But at the time, I was just totally like, what is going on? I just had no clue what was happening.
Yeah. To go back a little bit, when you did return to the WWF at the time, in 98, it seemed like they would kind of start and stop with, as far as the Al Snow character and head and what they wanted to do with it, you know, where there was a few moments where you were rumored to come out and they would pass the heads out to the crowd and then you wouldn't come out. And it just seemed like they were unsure how they wanted to pursue the character.
Yeah.
From your perspective, what do you think the idea was when you were returning? Was it laid out to you, or was it kind of like, let's give this character a shot and see how it goes?
No, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Yeah. And part of that too was my fault, you know, and I hope I'm not sounding like I'm being audacious or braggadocious or egotistical, but I mean, I was really, truly over.
Yes.
And my mistake was not grasping that at the time and understanding that and understanding what was the thing that got me over and then continuing to capitalize on. And that was my responsibility. And I kind of dropped the ball in that regard because I was still very much focused. When I left, and I left with a purpose from WWE, I left and asked to go to ECW, or I asked for my release, and then they rolled over my contract. Hmm. I left because I knew if I stayed there, I would no longer have a career. Then I would have to go someplace else and get myself over. And I did. I went to ECW with that sole purpose and that sole thought process. When I did finally get over, I went back into that, I want to be a great wrestler. I want to have great matches mode. Instead of using the opportunity that I had presented in front of me to make myself an attraction and to capitalize on what I had, you know, and use the television time that I was given more as a commercial, which is what it really is, mm-hmm. as opposed to just a wrestling match. And, you know, that was my short-sightedness. I think to some degree, you know, theirs was that they didn't quite understand the character, and I didn't ever come forth and explain fully in depth. You know, everybody thinks that what does everybody want? What does everybody need? Was a double entendre that I, you know, made a remark about, you know, because it was funny, but it wasn't a double entendre. I wasn't saying that what does everybody want like a blowjob. Mm-hmm. I was saying what does everybody want, and I would say, and they'd say the head. So if you can understand the character, the frustration of trying to be successful for so many years, and now you finally are, but what does everybody want? What's everybody need? What does everybody love? Well, not me, not Al Snow. They're not chanting for me. They're not wanting me. They're not loving me. They don't need me. They want and love and need the head.
Wow. I never.
And at some point, I was, you know, and I never mentioned it, but the idea was for me, I'm thinking that, you know, I'm thinking at some point I'm going to turn on the head because I'm going to get jealous. And I literally was planning on having, you know, an angle with the head. And I don't think they saw that. I don't think they got that. And the same goes, you know, when I got that bloodbath from the brood, I brought out the Fear Me head because I was going to start having multiple heads that would have something written different across their forehead that would represent different mental states, and started doing that on my own. And, you know, and Vince didn't get like that and didn't get it. And I don't think he ever quite got the gimmick. You know, Russo did, and I can't thank Russo enough because he was the one who facilitated the whole thing, you know, for coming back. But, you know, I don't think Vince ever quite got and understood what was really going on.
Ben, and that's what I was going to ask you next, because obviously Vince Russo was there when you returned up until he left for WCW about a year and a half later. So you did enjoy working with Vince Russo at that time then?
Oh, God, I love Vince. Listen, and everybody should, you know, I don't know why anybody should ever knock Vince because, it was it was the synergy between Vince Russo and Vince McMahon that, you know, led to, so, you know, the business that we had back then. And then, and that was what opened the door for so many guys to get opportunities that may not have ever gotten an opportunity, and for the creation of characters that people still remember today, you know. And that's a very, very large part because of Vince Russo.
You know, and it seemed like this happened with a lot of guys who came from ECW, is that you wound up in the hardcore title division. Did that bother you to be kind of pigeonholed in that division at that time, or was that a style that you were, you know, you enjoyed working, or would you rather not, you know what I'm saying, not have had those style matches?
I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, it's all a different way to tell a different story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all that matters, and at the end of the day, and I enjoyed it. It was my little unique thing, and you know, I'd actually, you know, the first time in Worcester was a complete accident where Road Dogg and I fell out of the building and out in the snow, and then that was kind of the thing, you know, where they always wanted every time for me to go somewhere else out of the building. You know, I was the only guy that did that.
Yeah,
and that was kind of my deal.
And you and Bob.
Now that they've had other ones do it since, but you know, really, that was me. I was the one that did it. So.
And you and Bob Holly had some memorable moments, you know, obviously to this day that still live on the network and everything.
Sure. Yeah. Bob's great. You know, he's fantastic. You know, and I can't thank, you know, Vince McMahon and WWE enough, you know, for all of the opportunities that even, you know, unfortunately I was too short-sighted and, you know, too blind to see at the time that I had. And, you know, even in my first run, you know, I had opportunities, and that's my only regret, is that, you know, but you know, not taking more advantage of those opportunities that were given to me at that time. And I would have had an entirely different career if I knew then what I know now. And that's the problem, is that, you know, you can have all the information you want, but until you have the commensurate amount of experience, you really don't have knowledge.
Sure.
And you know, and unfortunately, I mean, you know, the only way to get an experience is to make mistakes. And, you know, but I think, regardless of what some people might think, I had a great run with WWE. I had a tremendous career, had an awesome time. And I can't, you know, I had so many wonderful experiences, both in the ring, out of the ring, getting the opportunity to do Tough Enough, you know, being a commentator with, you know, Michael Cole and Coach, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, it just was such an awesome time in my career.
When Tough Enough originally came about, how did you feel about the concept? And I guess the question would be, what do you think they could have done maybe differently to, because you see how successful The Ultimate Fighter became, and it's kind of a similar show type. Do you think Tough Enough could have went further? I guess
kind of a
question.
Similar. It was completely a ripoff of Tough Enough.
Yeah, right.
It was, and Dana White will even say it. It was a complete ripoff of Tough Enough. And you know, how could it have been even more successful? I guess, you know, if we had just had, I don't know. I mean, it was very successful. It did a great job. The only, you know, it was a fantastic all around vehicle for professional wrestling, because it was a way to allow people to, without exposing, because it never exposed anything in it, but it showed just how hard, you know, a person who wants to pursue this has to physically work, how emotionally and mentally challenging it is, and, you know, just how much passion that these people have to try to be a professional wrestler. And it was a great way to scout for talent. It was a great way to, you know, create new audience members.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't tell you how many people still to this day, you know, I never watched wrestling, or my wife never watched wrestling, but, oh, they'd watch Tough Enough. And then next thing you know, they started watching wrestling with us, and blah, 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 blah. You know, it was fantastic. And it did the same thing for UFC. You know, Dana White even says that it was instrumental in the boom that UFC now has, because it allowed the audience to identify the characters of the fighters and to now care about who actually won and who lost. And that was something that was missing in the UFC at the time. And that's where that whole, the UFC took off, you know. And at the time, Spike TV had approached WWE about doing Tough Enough. And, you know, for whatever reason, they turned it down.
Yeah.
And that was what opened the door for Dana White and Ultimate Fighter to step in. And then and lead to where we still where we are now right now, where we're, you know, everybody's talking about Conor McGregor, who's brilliant, you know, saying that, you know, he'd slap the crap out of all the WWE wrestlers.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, there's some guys that seem to take that very seriously, and there's some that look at it like, well, he's just trying to either make some money or get some attention. I guess you're in the latter.
Well, he is.
Yeah, exactly.
He's trying to get over.
Yeah.
You know what? And so what? Big deal. And so what? But, you know, think about it. WWE is so over that a fighter in UFC has to try to put, you know, bury the wrestlers in WWE so that he can get himself over. So why are you going to get high about that? That means you're more over than Conor McGregor. Because let's face it, Conor, at the end of the day, ain't nobody going to book Conor McGregor in WWE. And I guarantee that they'd be booking some guys from WWE in UFC. Because they are.
Yep.
Brock Lesnar was the biggest star in UFC. And why was he the biggest star in UFC? Not because he's a great fighter, but because he was already a star from WWE. CM Punk is in UFC for one reason. Why? Because he was a star in WWE. So Conor McGregor, if it weren't for us, there wouldn't be no you.
Coming aboard as a sponsor with Creative Control Daily this week, I am happy to join forces with the Collar and Elbow brand. Collar and Elbow, where wrestling passion meets street fashion. Now, I'm sure my listeners have heard of the Collar and Elbow brand, brought to you by the great Al Snow, where the idea is to make cool shirts for wrestling fans. You know, cool shirts to wear out, cool shirts to wear to the gym, cool shirts for wrestling fans to not be ashamed to wear in public. You know, initially I got a Collar and Elbow shirt and hat due to the fact that Collar and Elbow became associated with Keeping It 100 with Conan. So I got them free, on the cuff, on the arm, if you will. What I found from there is the shirts were excellent. Excellent material, the fit was great, and the fitted hat was pretty sweet as well. So, go check out collarandelbowbrand.com, and I'm sure you'll agree. There's a lot of cool designs on there that you wouldn't be ashamed to wear out of the house. And the material is extremely comfortable just for lounging around in, maybe working out, whatever you want to do. And lucky for you, the Creative Control Daily listeners, I've got a deal for you. That's right, to get you 10% off your purchase. It'll get you a discount off some awesome Collar and Elbow gear as well as help the show out. 10% off with the code CCDAILY. CCDAILY. That's right, 10% off at collarandelbowbrand.com with the code CCDAILY. Don't be afraid to represent. Support the show. Support Al Snow and his great company, Collar and Elbow. You won't regret buying their stuff. Honest to God, they're the most comfortable shirts I own.
Now, you're in TNA now, and, you know, there's some fans that, you know, haven't given TNA a chance in quite some time. So if you were to speak to them now and say, hey, this is what's going on now in TNA, these are the guys that you need to take a look at, this is the talent that we have now, who would you really recommend to the fans? Hey, you need to turn to the program to see these guys.
The whole roster.
Yeah.
You know, everybody works so hard and, you know, is so talented and, you know, you've got to realize, too, you know, everybody's got to realize, you know, TNA is a fledgling company that is taking on, you know, WWE, which is an iconic brand. And WWE has been around for decades, so they've had their chances to make all the mistakes and, you know, do things wrong, you know, and survive. And, you know, TNA has only been around for, I don't know how many years, but, you know,
14,
12, yeah, 14, something, I don't know. That's not a whole lot of time in the business world. Usually it takes you 5 just to be able to draw any money out of it. So in the wrestling world, it's even harder. And, you know, they put on a show that equals, in lots of levels, WWE. But you got to understand, they do it with probably a third, maybe now, a little less than that, a quarter of the budget. They certainly are doing it with about an eighth of the amount of staff. And they're still able to produce a show that is network worthy on a national and international basis. So why are you knocking it? It doesn't make any sense to me. But again, that's the dichotomy of professional wrestling fans these days.
Absolutely.
It goes all full circle back to kayfabe. Kayfabe was a respect for the business and respect for the audience that's now not being hasn't been adhered to for years. Who cares? That's old school. And what has happened is it allows information to flow freely out to an audience, a very small, vocal minority audience, secular audience, just very, very self-contained, that now, because they have a little bit of information, they become familiar with what they think is going on with professional wrestling. And familiarity breeds contempt. Have you ever heard that saying?
Yes, absolutely.
And the only other one that is more true is misery loves company. Familiarity breeds contempt. And the small vocal minority that now try in every effort to dictate the creativity and the direction of professional wrestling, because they now are familiar with it and believe they have knowledge when they really don't. All they've got is information. They have no actual experience. But therefore, the more they become familiar and the more information they get, the more contemptuous they get of the very thing that they're supposed to love and enjoy and can't enjoy anymore, because now they feel like they're on the inside, that they've never been on the inside of. That hence why we always tried to, used to, adhere to kayfabe.
Yeah, I've never understood when you hear a fan or see a internet post or something like that that says, someone that would hope, I hope TNA dies, or, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you wish for something like that? It's giving wrestlers jobs. It's giving referees jobs, agents, producers. It's another option for your entertainment. I never understood that amount of negativity.
Because they're familiar with the inner workings of professional wrestling. Yeah. And they now feel contemptuous of the very thing that they know actually nothing about. I don't care how long you've been watching something. I don't care how in depth of a fan you are. I don't care how much information you have. I don't care any of that. Until you actually have been physically in the ring, until you've actually had to perform on a regular basis, and your performance is judged on two factors. You're either the thing that is making people buy tickets and set their butts in those seats, or you're one of the things that's helping. There is no third option. And until your performance is evaluated on that, and you are always out there trying to perform and motivate more people so that you can feed your family better and have a little bit of security, because all it takes is that one mistake, until you have that experience, you don't know anything. I don't care who you are or how much they claim you're an expert. I don't care how much information you acquired over the years, how many different wrestlers have told you different things. Just remember, every wrestler that tells you something is the hero of their own story. They have their own slant on it. So until you've actually been in that ring to some degree, until you've actually been a part of, not just in the ring, but a part of the show that has to, because every person that's a part of that show has to motivate an audience to pay to see it. Until you've been a part of that in some degree, some fashion, some form, you don't have any actual knowledge because you have no experience. It's like me saying that I know everything about the medical field and that I am know as much as a doctor simply because I'm on Google and I read the New England Journal of Medical Science and that I've been a fan of every medical show that's ever been on TV. It's absurd.
So you're saying that, Dave Meltzer and Wade Keller aren't the end-all, be-all, see-all experts?
I respect them and I believe that they have a certain amount of information, mm-hmm. They don't have any real knowledge. They've never, ever actually been a part of the wrestling business. As much as they'd like to lead people to believe, they haven't. And unfortunately, the performers, and even worse, those that are within the business that are now in that wrestling bubble, allow those people that have just information but are vocal and contemptuous to dictate the direction and the creative outlet of professional wrestling. And that's the thing that drives me nuts.
Yeah.
Drives me completely insane.
I've had you for a little bit over 50 minutes, and obviously I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So if you want to, let's talk about the Al Snow Wrestling Academy in the UK and
okay.
What led to its, what led to the birth of the Academy and why the United Kingdom?
Well, I met my business partner in London. And we hit it off, and we got to talking about doing a wrestling school, which I was very against doing, because they're, to be quite honest, there's just a plethora of them in the United States. I mean, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry can have one, which has really led, what's a lot's led to the degradation of professional wrestling, is that, you know, one guy learns something and has only 6 months or a year or 2 years, it doesn't matter what, but he's only got a certain amount of experience, and that's only working on the weekends or only, you know, and every then only probably one night, once a month or two times a month. And I'm not knocking anybody, but they now think that they have enough experience, which now has the commensurate amount of knowledge to now teach other people. And then it just goes from there. And in England, there are fewer schools. There are a lot of the older World of Sport guys that are still around.
Right.
There's not the presence of WWE right now, like there is here in the United States. So the independent wrestling, as you, if you want to call it that, in England is thriving. It's a place where there's a lot of quality talent, and there, you know, athleticism, raw athleticism that, you know, I can go there and tap into, and I can, you know, I think that it will make the school itself successful, because that's, and that's what I always used to tell everybody when I had my own school and when I was the head trainer in OVW, was that I want every single person I train to succeed, because every single person that succeeds makes me now more successful.
Right.
And I believe that going to, you know, England gives me the biggest opportunity for that. And I have a staff of trainers that have a tremendous amount of experience. Joe Legend has wrestled for both TNA, WWE, and he's literally been all over the world on his own. I mean, and I'm not kidding, all over, he's wrestled in Nepal. Who knew that there was wrestling in Nepal? You know?
Yeah.
He went to the Himalayas and wrestled. Who wrestles in the Himalayas? You know? He Doug Williams, who's been, you know, has 20 years of experience and, you know, is a master carpenter, master journeyman, master, you know, worker, you know, and he does it, you know, Joe Legend and Doug Williams, they do it for a living, and they've done it for a living. That experience, you know, of doing it for a living gives them an edge. And Johnny Storm and John Klinger, Bad Bones from Germany, you know, Thiago Miguel from Portugal. I've been able to, by going to England, I've been able to assemble a group of a very talented, very experienced, and that's the key, experienced staff of trainers that all agree, we all have the same philosophical voice, but everybody has their own unique individual styles that now, you know, these guys can learn a little bit from everyone and can come out even more well-rounded and more prepared for any opportunity that may come up. So that was why I, you know, located the Academy of England.
And that's at alsnowwrestling.com, correct?
That is Al Snow. It's Al Snow. Crap. I just forgot my own website. Al Snow Wrestling Academy .com. Yes. Yeah. And it will be moving to Al Snow Wrestling Academy .uk.com.
And from when I was researching it, it was said to open in the summer. So I'd imagine it's open and running now.
We opened it up in the, at the end of April. We've been operating now from April, May, June, and July. We're on a break right now. In August, we'll start back up with the new semester in September. We have probably, I think last count, about 60 students at this time. We have three classes, beginners, intermediate, and advanced. We'll have guest trainers who will come in. We'll be doing our own events, you know, it's very exciting. I'm really excited to get to do it.
Now, you also, we mentioned acting a little bit earlier. You have a film on Amazon Prime now called Overtime. How did you get into into the acting game?
Well, I can only wrestle for so long, and like we talked about, I need an outlet for the madness, and I've got to find another rabbit hole, and that was what kind of got me involved. I've done a great number of movies over the last few years, Lake Erie, Alice D, Penny Dreadful, Witches of Oz. A lot of different movies. Lost Prevention just recently. Mm. But Overtime, you know, I got to be the star of, and it's been out for several years now, but they just put it on Amazon Prime, and it's a fun movie. It's kind of reminiscent of Big Trouble in Little China. And you know, eventually when I get, you know, start pulling myself more physically away from wrestling, I'll devote more time to acting and try to develop an acting career. So it's a completely different world, completely different challenges, you know, but having the experience in professional wrestling does help, but it's not a be-all, end-all that just opens the door for you in acting. You've got to go in and kind of basically do the same thing as you do building a career in wrestling. That's pay your dues, and that's what I'm doing, and I love it. Don't love it as much as professional wrestling. I don't think there'll ever be anything that I'll love as much as professional wrestling, but it's a lot physically. It's a lot easier on me. So
do you have a year in your head or a time limit or how much longer you think you'll be active in ring? I mean, I know you're still doing some things for TNA on television and wrestling indies and things like that. Do you have some kind of, you know, like I said, a time limit or something in your head?
I don't have any specific time limit, but you know, probably soon, probably sometime in, you know, I'll probably just, you know, stop, retire. You know, it's been 34 years, not just being in the wrestling business, but 34 years that I've been performing in the ring.
Yeah.
And I'm working on my 35th. Maybe, you know, once I get the 35th year in, maybe that'll be it. Maybe that'll be the time that I go, well, okay, that's it. You know, I don't know. I just, as long as I hope physically that I'm not, the day that I become physically an embarrassment in the ring, that's when I need to stop. You know, if I can't perform in a realistic fashion and make even for a few seconds an audience believe, or even for a second go, well, I know this is like, this kind of seems, I can't have a chance to do that physically, but I need to quit. And I'm sure some people will probably say, you probably should have quit years ago, but hey, that's okay.
Well, Al, thank you very much for your time and coming on. Al Snow is on Twitter at The Real Al Snow. He's also on Facebook at Real Al Snow. And as we covered, there's a movie Overtime on Amazon Prime that Al stars in, as well as go to AlSnowWrestlingAcademy.com to check out the Al Snow Wrestling Academy over in the United Kingdom. And anything else you want to add, Al?
We also have, Al Snow Academy also has a Facebook page, and, you know, because we're working on getting a website up and running, but you want to, you can reach out to us on the Facebook page and ask any questions you want, and we'll answer them.
Excellent. So. Well, thank you very much for coming on, answering the questions, being very forthright and everything. And, you know, maybe sometime in the future, we can have you back on for part two and catch all the stuff that I missed, because I know I missed quite a few things.
Oh,
but
great.
Excellent.
I would love to.
Cool.
That'd be terrific.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Alan. You know, have a good night, and take care, my friend.
Oh, thank you very much, Joe.
All right.
Take care, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You see this? Take a look. Pay attention. Used to be the rule. A place like this, Al Snow's Wrestling Academy, used to be the rule in the sport of professional wrestling, where young men and young women could come and learn the skills, the respect, the humility that it takes to survive and succeed in the sport of professional wrestling. Unfortunately, now this is the exception. No longer the rule. Now the door's wide open. Anybody, all they have to do is have a dream. They can walk in. And Shira and Grado are a prime example of that. Just because you have the heart, you have the desire, you have the passion, you have a dream. Oh, I'll do anything to be a professional wrestler, Al Snow. Anything. But we're going to find out tonight. We're going to find out if you will do anything. You'll do what it takes, because I can guarantee you I'll do whatever it takes to keep my sport the way it is, because it's gone to hell everywhere else. But I'm going to be just like Donald Trump. He's making America great. And how is he making America great? How is he making America great? He's not just letting anybody in it anymore. And I'm going to do the same thing for professional wrestling. I'm no longer going to let the door stand wide open. Nope. Shutting it closed. And I'm starting with you, Grado, and I'm starting with you, Shira. I'm shutting the door in your face.